Well, here is the good for nothing, sitting among us and grinning with this slightly idiotic, over-friendly grin and smiling this dubious smile devoid of strategy and tactics. This dear human being who has been cast adrift, with whom nobody can be angry. If only he hadn't returned the mission for the future to its sender and made us feel like strangers in our own homes. Suddenly we feel condemned to actuality. It feels like a reformed prison. The alibi of improvement has collapsed. The objections to change have been resolved. We are facing a decisive moment like convicted loan swindlers and are not prepared for most of its reclamations. By now, I think it must be clear why I do not want to discuss the future of art in the first digression, but the future of the future instead. And before I come to that, I want to indicate briefly what I shall say in the third digression from the subject of art. It will be confined to a short reflection that uses a radical turn in thinking to revitalize the risk that was once called philosophy. In this third digression, I use meditational philosophy to attempt to interpret the essence of an existentially significant experience of art, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I am assuming, incidentally, that it is already absolutely indispensable now to have a kind of art whose future form I can describe, but indispensable in a way that is not affected by Hegel's thesis about the end of art. Conversely, I assume that a kind of art which can prove its indispensability will provide for itself in its own time and defy any kind of expectation. In fact, it will clearly show that essential experience of art can only be gained by rejecting conscious expectations. Finally, it remains to be asked why aesthetic experience through art is sometimes indispensable. The answer is so elementary, and the aspiration of this elementary quality is so radical that neither the answer nor the aspiration can be formulated philosophically. Because philosophical thought is not elementary enough, or radical enough for this answer, it can only be formulated with the additional qualification that the formulation will destroy and distort its object. There is no alternative, and the mistake that will become clear here is a mistake it is impossible to avoid making. The reason lies in the nature of the thing itself, because being mentally awake inherently means being able to withdraw from the idea as it is being formulated, with the result that, at most, all that remains of the mental awareness in the formulation is a remnant, like a shed skin, which indicates that we would have found quick thinking here yesterday if we had happened to be here. But now we have to be content with its traces, with the present signs of an absent person. Having said that, we are in a position to answer the question of indispensable things in the arts. Art can prove its indispensability even, and especially after Hegel, if and because, in the midst of the modern culture of reason and will, it embodies the most important and best legitimated approach to the dimension of mental alertness. From the arts, it is a short stretch to what philosophical jargon calls decentered consciousness, meaning the form of consciousness in which the self surrenders the strategic centre of being in the world in favour of a state of belonging without a central focus. It is the state of being of meditation, if we can quickly agree not to use the name of meditation for the state in which some people sit half asleep in a holy stupor with their legs crossed, only to lose the last link with reality. Instead, the concept of meditation should stand for those forms of practice that can help to dissolve the illusion of the psychic central perspective and the focus on a strategic self. In my opinion, the arts have represented the most important complex of quasi-meditative exercise systems in the modern tradition. They have created, as it were, a school of Western sensual and intellectual yoga, a way of symbolic exertion. It seems to me that in alternating between aesthetics of regulation and freedom of expression, and between skilled discipline and relaxed play, they evolve the most effective kind of Western tantrism, if we may call it that, a non-dualist, amoral discipline with the intensity of things that occur without a subject, and this intensity gives it the seal of truth. The modern arts that can be interpreted through tantrism offer many individuals the experience of a sensual, physical, non-conceptual school of consciousness of being. We should not forget, however, that this para-meditative quality of modern arts has been generally suppressed today because the artist has become more important than his or her medium. The majority of artists see the disciplines of art as an excuse for lack of discipline. In other words, for an opportunity to spit into the spittoon of the public arena. They easily forget that art by its nature is an anonymous master whose truth unfolds only by externalization. However, people who unconditionally surrender to art, the master that begins with seduction but later becomes unyielding, can discover in the moment of success that they are in the grip of a gentle yet revolutionary experience. They can discover that beyond knowing and wanting, they have always been part of a consciousness that is non-protruding and non-objectifying. Anyone who learns this as an artist is superior to any philosopher, just as a mentally alert person can win the argument against a blabbermouth. In the living process, as it happens, a kind of eventful calmness may emerge that overrides the highly developed consciousness of the skills of strategic, technical and artistic subjectivity. This is in fact the salient point of meditation. In the pure process of meditation, there is a dissolution of the distancing mechanism whereby the self as self is positioned in relation to objects. The voracious transitivity of productive action and imaginative thinking is arrested and transformed into the intransitivity of the unimaginable event. Anyone who knows this also knows the magical flair of the present. And he or she knows the dimension of life that can never lose its spell, even under the pressure of the theoretical and practical banality of modern objectification. The fusion of otherwise ruptured subjectivity into the accomplishment of the work of art is part of the metaphysical hallmark of the modern arts. Its power is based on captivating the divided and divisive self through the experience of an undivided, intense presence. It is clear then why the arts are indispensable on the one hand and very confusing on the other. We've already talked about their indispensability. Their confusing danger is due to the fact that art often does not know what it is. Artists are very happy to forget that only a hair's breadth divides the path of symbolic exertion from the narcissistic career. The arts have become a wonderful excuse for confusing the way with the goal. The arts have long since become goals in themselves and have strayed onto the path of stupidity, the path of top achievement, of commitment, of the imposing artist and of helpless good intentions. Art is magnificent. Artists are skilled at doing what they are skilled at, and the arrow always hits the mark. But the important thing is to know that if you hit the mark, you miss everything else. Ladies and gentlemen, so far I have explained how my text is structured. As there is not much time left, I should speed up to get to what I have announced. But I am sure that you have already seen through this ploy long ago. If everything is done the right way and its announcements have to be followed by what is announced, then I should now be obliged first to speak about the future of the future, then about the so-called social dynamics of the field of aesthetic therapy in modern society, and finally about the fundamental principles of art in relation to meditational philosophy. The only question for now is whether everything is being done properly. You have probably already guessed the answer. Nothing will come of this. Nothing will come of all this. We probably went too fast today. Normally this three-part announcement would have to roll towards you frontally, so to speak, and I could guarantee you that the whole of the next hour would seem quite familiar to you. I will put it differently. If a future plan really contained the future, if the grammatical future were the ontological mortar for establishing future events and speeches, or if a loan were really paid back in the same currency in which it was made, we would all be in a miserable situation. Our life would almost belong to the bankers. The prophets of apocalypse would be necessarily right. Then the peace that was loaned with weapons would be paid back with war. And in the end, I would have to read out word for word everything that I've just presented in the compact style of an announcement. And you would recognize it as precisely that and would think, ah, we've heard it all before, and for God's sake, don't repeat it. Please give us something new, something worth the effort of being here and paying attention. I do not mean the attention from earlier, for the phrases from earlier, because those phrases are already at the place where the dead are to be found, the place where realists through the ages have sat on the ideological sidelines and reckoned with the eternal return of the same thing, because they know that when we are mentally absent, repetitions define reality. No, I mean the latest attention, the wildest and most incredible attention we have. I mean the almost malevolent wakefulness where nothing has to be said twice. Well, I can see that you have seen through my ploy. You have heard that I have said everything I announced through to the very end as far as possible, here on the spot. And this is a very simple tactic. It involves shooting the arrow of expectation into the future in such a way that it can always fall back onto the soil of the moment. It is a matter of looking ahead openly and steadily without repeating oneself. I admit it was a rather cheap ruse, but I didn't find a better one for expressing what is involved in the future of art or in the future of the future as such. When I immediately do and say and not do and not say what is really to be done, to be said, to not be done and not be said, then there will never be anything left to do, to say, to not do, or not say. Every challenge will meet people where who are there to accept it. That is rarely the case when absence of mind holds sway. We always arrive too late. We always arrive just in time to see that we have arrived too late. For if I immediately do and not do, and say and not say what should happen and should not happen, I will later have to scrape yesterday's burnt intentions off the bottom of today's pot. I will be preoccupied by the fact that I have postponed yesterday until today. I will be shackled by incomplete negativity. Failures and reminders will pile up on the desk of life. Missed chances will crowd at the entrance to the present like relentless creditors. We will only leave the house armed with good excuses. Life becomes a very complicated and frustrating business of fulfilling plans and catching up, a miserable game of postponement and avoidance, a refinancing and repayment action of the kind required from people who live in the blessed times when announcing, postponing, and borrowing money are still supposed to help. Incidentally, what is called world history is only this kind of refinancing action on a large scale arranged between the generations. It is what results when too many people postpone too many things for too long, in the absurd hope that they will get away with it this time. But if people live in a state of postponement, the unfinished past that defines them will inexorably catch up with them. In this respect, Heidegger's maxim that our past is mostly what lies ahead of us is very apt. I am sure, of course, that it is unfair, not to say disrespectful, to use word games to turn an occasion for calmly creating theory, such as an academic lecture, into a mindfulness exercise in meditational philosophy. How can that be justified? My reference is what I attempted in the Critique of Cynical Reason as the beginning of a philosophical anti-philosophy. In that book, I showed the need for a kind of mental wakefulness that evolves beyond automatic moralizing ideas and the normed discourse that are presented as theory, and beyond the routine reflex activities that are popular as practice among people of sound common sense. The Critique of Cynical Reason, however flawed, was an attempt to bring philosophy a step forward towards a school of mental wakefulness. We have to go beyond the outworn duality of theory and practice, of imagination and production, of concept and execution. An expansion of intelligence into new dimensions is already present in the current process of theory and practice. Much depends on whether we succeed in responding to these new constellations of theoretical and practical intelligence, to overcome hopeless pragmatism and even more hopeless young Hegelianism. Today's philosophy is taking off into the dimension of mental alertness, which has to expand in a way as a third dimension above theory and practice. Borrowing from the great tradition of Eastern and Western schools of mindfulness, I call this third dimension of an intelligent way of being in the world meditation or Dhyana. The current talk about the end of philosophy can assume a new positive meaning if we realize that what is smarter in the relation to theory cannot be a different kind of theoretical philosophy, just as what is smarter in relation to practice cannot be a different practice, even if it is the practice of the theory. Rather, theory and practice must submerge together and be transformed into the medium of a kind of meditative atmosphere that includes mental alertness. Philosophy, after the end of philosophy, will be meditational practice and meditational theory. At the high levels of complexity of a scientific, political, and aesthetic intelligence communicated by mental wakefulness, we are dealing with a new combination of dimensions of intelligence. In other words, with meditation on theoretical practice, theory on practical meditation, practice on meditational theory, and so forth. A combination like this offers the contours of higher level forms of intelligence, and the earlier a culture of meditation becomes more widely accepted on the modern level, the better it will be for a world threatened with destruction by the proliferation of clever idiocy and narrow-minded intelligence. Many avant-garde groups experimenting with new forms and connections in science, technology, art, and meditation are already developing a new process to create more subtle communications and more useful divisions between ideas, actions, and events. I would argue that this is where the real art of the coming arts is emerging. I am certain that it is the beginning of a new ecology of spirit, and the present announcement is not made as an empty prognosis, or the credits list of Never and Company. It is made in the form of the growth of real intelligence. This can be witnessed by anybody who decides to be a person of our times and to make his or her home in the sphere of mental wakefulness. I will end by being a trifle indiscreet and revealing a secret to you that Albert Einstein told me recently across the ether. Einstein appeared to me in a dream about a week ago. He was very friendly and open, and actually refrained from sticking out his tongue. He seemed to be in a very good mood, like somebody who was mischievously happy about a new discovery. He told me that he had recalculated his much misunderstood energy equation with his colleague God, or rather with God's third person, and he almost went mad after slightly changing the factors. And he almost went mad when, after slightly changing the factors, he suddenly found the universal formula. In fact, much more than that, he became the universal formula himself. Well, I do not have the slightest idea about modern physics, but my skeptical hackles rose at such an arrogant hypothesis. So I told Einstein that I couldn't imagine it, however hard I tried. When he offered to tell me the formula, I had to admit truthfully that it would be a waste of effort because I am such an absolute ignoramus about physics. But Einstein showed such childish enthusiasm for his new formula and was so obviously enjoying the interdisciplinary inspiration that in the end I felt obliged to say politely that I thought his discovery was very interesting. He then went over to a blackboard to write out the formula and was poised to do so when he started becoming very transparent and watery. I was worried he would disappear at any moment without his formula. But he pulled himself together, and as he wrote himself on the blackboard, I discovered that I couldn't hear or see because, if I remember rightly, he wrote, universe, U, equals intelligence, I, minus anti-intelligence, AT, with the condition, I equals meditation divided by the resistance factor of imagination in time, AT equals resistance material multiplied by the square of the average of chair glue. After Einstein had nearly filled the whole blackboard, he mentioned that his colleague, Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, was already on the right track to the universal formula, but for the sake of the world, he should really put the persistency coefficient in a different place. Then Einstein and the blackboard blew up together, and all that was left of the whole show was a sort of ticklish feeling in the atmosphere that I immediately identified, despite my deficient knowledge of physics, as cosmic background giggling. To conclude, the present will show which past the future will bring. The present will show which past the future will bring. If the past is the space in which the Persian Wars, the Crusades and the First, Second and Third World Wars all happen at the same time. The future is a space in which we shall see whether Einstein's dreams are made of froth. Today, as a follow-up of philosophy, a form of consciousness conducive to new kinds of relationship between mind and event is emerging, helped by a mentally awake way of thinking, a consciousness beyond the outworn old European duality of theory and practice. If the main event of history is human intelligence itself, the emergence of a superior intelligence will become the condition for history to go on, which it will do only if human beings survive the self-imposed risk of a dull, numbed intelligence tied to the egoism of strategic self-preservation. In this higher process of emergence, doctrines evolve that could be called non-Euclidean studies in cleverness and subjects such as acting with restraint, intervening out of meditation, guiding processes by letting things happen, trusting intelligent impulses and revolutionary calm. In the process, new exchange regulations for seriousness and lack of seriousness will develop after good old irony proves inadequate for communication with a world that thinks the apex of cleverness is to have destroyed itself by being wonderfully astute in a future past. Enlightenment today, ladies and gentlemen, is nothing but using the perspective of meditational philosophy to overcome the exact future. Enlightenment today takes the form of something produced by a meditative cybernetics to promote a present with a future and an art of being mentally present and aware. And however much we have tried to escape into mental absence, we have already taken at least one step into this state of mental awareness.